says, her voice softer than I've ever heard it. Even when she's exhausted, her words normally have a sharp edge or a teasing warmth.
It's harder than I thought it would be.
That's okay. I can help. That's why you're here, remember? She gives me an encouraging smile, and for a moment, I forget what I nearly did tonight. I crouch in front of her, patting my knee for her to rest her ankle on. She does, gingerly, and I rub my hands together to warm them, an action that causes a flicker of a crease between her brows as she watches. Does it hurt? Rose shrugs and looks away, a hard swallow shifting in the column of her throat.
A bit.
It's okay if this stuff bothers you.
It doesn't,
she says firmly, though it's not entirely convincing and she knows it. With a resigned sigh, she says,
the bone sticking out was just a bit much. It's hard to forget.
That's understandable. I tug a little at the edge of the adhesive tape and she hisses as it pulls the hairs that have grown beneath it.
The fur is really adding to the experience for me.
I snort. What?
Look.
She plunks her other foot on my knee to compare the difference between her freshly shaven skin still glowing from the hot water and the leg she hasn't touched, the fine dark hairs glinting in the dim light. She points to her swollen leg, the marks of the brace still imprinted on her flesh.
Fur.
I nearly say something stupid like, I like carpet, or fur is hot, or probably 50 other dumbass options that suddenly cancel out anything professional or, God forbid, clever. I clear my throat and try to focus on the bandage, lifting one edge enough to check that the stitches haven't stuck to the surface of the gauze. Fur's human.
Fur hurts like a bitch when it gets stuck in tape.
Just wait until you get the cast.
It'll hurt?
No, but once we take it off, you might be able to braid it.
Doc,
she says through a giggle as she prods me with her toes.
You're supposed to be helping.
I am helping. I'm distracting you, so I can do this, I declare as I tear off the bandage.
Motherfucker!
She shrieks. She grips my wrist and laughs, her eyes wide. I know I'm grinning at her like a fucking fool, but I can't seem to make myself stop.
I'm 99% sure you have no credentials at all, and you won your stethoscope at the duck pond game.
Rose lets go of my wrist only to whack me on the arm and then lean back, her smile slowly fading. It takes me a moment to realize mine has evaporated too. The ease of her touch makes it hard to hold on to words I shouldn't say. It's a struggle to quell the sudden urge to tell her how beautifully her skin glows in this light, or how funny and unique she is, or how grateful I am for the warmth of her touch, her presence. Just like I try not to think about how she's naked under this plush robe. The hand she rests on her lap is the only thing keeping it from falling completely open.
Maybe you've got a little vicious streak hidden away in you, Dr. Kane,
Rose says. And my thoughts of her body give way to images of Matthew Cranwell's barn. I can still feel the weight of the wrench in my hand, the burn of rage in my veins. I don't know if it's something about my expression that changes, or if she just senses the shift in the air, but Rose grabs my hand. She opens my palm and lays a damp sponge there.
But you've got a kind streak too, and I like them both, equally.
Rose's smile is soft, her eyes warm. I try my best to smile back, to focus on the simple actions of care and healing. I clean her wound with a gentle hand, each press of the sponge against the incision a ritual. I seek comfort in giving it. The man I chose to be when I entered medical school, that's still the man I am. But she's right. Maybe I do have a vicious streak. And I need to remember that, because it doesn't seem so disconnected from the rest of me anymore.
Ta-da! Rose.
How does it feel?
Fionn asks as I swing next to him through the sliding hospital doors, my brand new fiberglass cast wrapped with black tape. It encases my entire lower leg, all the way from my knee to the ball of my foot, replacing the temporary brace now that my stitches are out. It's okay. A little weird, but I'll get used to it. Fionn smiles, and I try to do the same in reply, but I'm still feeling a little too queasy to put in much effort. I made the mistake of watching as he clipped and tugged the first two sutures free of my flesh. I had to look away as he took the rest of them out. But I shouldn't be too hard on myself. The stitches probably just brought back the memory of all that pain and adrenaline. Fuck, that was gross. I remember sitting on the floor of his clinic, cutting the bottom of my pant leg so I could get a better look at the injury. The last thing I recall before waking up in the ambulance is the splintered bone that jutted from the split skin. And that's it, aside from a hazy moment of seeing his face haloed by a bright light, an image that might be nothing more than a dream.
You sure you'll be okay for a couple of hours while I finish up here?
Yeah, I reply, squinting down the road in the direction of downtown Weyburn. I feel like I've hobbled around most of Hartford now. It would be good to explore someplace new. Fionn watches me, a crease notched between his brows as his eyes scour my face. Sometimes I feel like there's a heat in his gaze that lingers in my skin. And then with a blink, it always disappears, as though he shuttered it away, keeping that little flame hidden in the dark.
Be careful,
he says, as though it's a question he's not sure he should ask. Though he tries to keep his tone clinical and detached, I still sense a thread of worry woven in the note. Definitely. It might do me some good to move around, I reply.
Any trouble whatsoever, call me.
Yeah, of course. I'll be fine. With a flash of a smile that seems to do little to reassure him, I swing my way across the parking lot of McLean Memorial Hospital toward the empty sidewalk that will lead me to the shops. I glance back toward the entrance before turning the corner. I don't expect Fionn to be standing there, his arms crossed over his white coat. But he is. And I don't expect my heart to turn over when he raises a hand to wave at me. But it does. I give him a nod, and then I keep going. By the fifth block, I start to regret my life choices. I've gotten pretty good at maneuvering around with my crutches. The whole tick-swing-step rhythm is almost musical. But there's only so much crutch music a girl wants to make before it becomes crutch torture. My armpits are starting to chafe. The bistro a few blocks in the distance might as well be miles away. I need to rest for a minute, preferably somewhere with air conditioning and maybe an iced latte. I squint at the sandwich board of a store on the next block. Shireton Hunting and Fishing Supply. That'll do. I hobble my way to the small brick building, the first in the businesses that stretch along both sides of the tree-lined main street. When I pull the door open, the scent of leather and rubber and synthetic pine greets me. There are high-visibility orange vests. There's camo print in every format of green and beige blobs. Fishing rods, hooks and bait and fake fish and plastic worms. And knives. Short, long, serrated, smooth. Matte, powder-coated in black, shining silver, polished to a mirror finish. The shop owner is a grizzled-looking old man with buzzed white hair and trenches of wrinkles that cut patterns through his skin. He looks up from his fishing magazine and gives me a nod as he flicks a glance down to my cast. I've become used to the repetitive questions, and I have a practiced response ready to slide off my tongue. But he doesn't ask. He just gives me a curt but not unkind,
"Good morning."
Dips his fingers into a tin of snuff and slides a pinch of the mahogany tobacco between his lip and lower teeth before he returns to his magazine. I hobble down one of the long aisles and lose myself in the cool air and the rows of glass cases, taking my time to appreciate the finer details of every blade.
"Didn't I tell you that? I thought I fucking told you that."
A man snarls at the end of one of the aisles, his body hidden by a rack of waders and waterproof jackets.
"You are so fucking stupid."
I glance toward the front desk, but I don't think the shop owner heard, or if he did, he doesn't let on. The man on the phone snaps out a few more disparaging comments as I creep down the aisle next to his. When he temporarily halts his tirade, I hear a woman's muffled voice on the other end of the line, though I can't make out what she says. Only the tone. Placating. Pinched with fear.
I don't fucking care, Naomi.
My spine goes rigid. I'm standing in front of a stack of waiters hanging from an aisle rack, but I'm not really looking at them. Instead, I'm picturing the nurse, Naomi, and the way her smile never reached her eyes when I pulled her cards at the hospital. I'm seeing the dullness of the light in them, like they were too haunted to shine. I'm hearing her voice, the thinnest thread of hope in her words when I asked what the Ace of Cups meant to her. To take flight. I know exactly who this man is, what he's done, and where he needs to go. A burst of wicked glee explodes through my cells. I glance down at my cast. Maybe my bad luck wasn't so bad after all.
It's your problem.
The man continues, snapping me back into the moment.
And if you're not careful, I can make it even more of your problem. Unless you suddenly don't care if those photos of you make their way around town.
There's a quiet plea from the other end of the line.
I told you already that I'm going out tonight. And I swear to fucking God, if you aren't there when I get back, I'm going to—
I part the waiters with sudden force, the hangers grating against the metal rod. A man my age startles, the phone held a few inches from his face as he looks at me with wide, steel-blue eyes.
I'll call you back.
And then a slow grin spreads across his lips. Just to look at him, he's handsome enough, in an unfussy kind of way. Tousled dark hair, stubble on an angular jaw, those silvery eyes that light up when he smiles. I'm sure he's gotten away with all kinds of trouble with that smile. And he knows it.
Hi,
he says, his voice rich and smooth. I give him a faint nod. He waggles his phone and gives me a sheepish tilt of his head.
Sorry about that. Work thing. You know, people not doing their jobs and stuff. Trust me, they deserved it.
Yeah, I deadpan, though he doesn't seem to notice my sarcastic tone. I'm sure they did. Bet they won't fuck up again. His expression lightens and he takes a deep breath.
I hope you're right.
He jerks his head down to my leg.
What'd you do?
I lean forward through the waiters and cut my hand over my mouth. His eyes glimmer with anticipation of a secret shared. I broke it trying to kill a guy. I wink and he laughs, delight filling the aisle.
Now that's a story I'd like to hear more about sometime. Name's Eric.
He pauses, as though I'm going to give him my name in return. When I don't, it brightens the gleam in his eyes.
You like fishing?
Something like that, I reply, and his lips curl. I shrug and start hobbling my way back over to the knives. Eric follows, watching from the other side of the glass case as I turn my attention to the weapons just out of reach.
Do you have a secret fishing hole? I could use some tips, if so. Haven't caught anything all week. Maybe you could show me sometime.
I look up at him, tilting my head. A slow, predatory grin creeps across my lips. I think Naomi would mind, don't you? Eric's smile finally cracks, though doesn't disappear completely. He scoffs, pausing as though giving me one last chance to come to my senses. Then he rolls his eyes.
Dumb bitch,
he mutters. Loud enough for only me to hear. I stay where I am, my hands curled into tight fists, my nails etching crescents into the padding of my crutches as I watch him stride toward the counter. The shop owner sets his magazine down, his expression unreadable as his eyes flick to mine.
Afternoon. What can I get for you? I'll take a box of Winchester 350 Legends,
Eric says. The old man lets out a grunt, his eyes narrowing.
It ain't hunting season. Shouldn't you be getting fishing gear? I am. Gonna shoot the fish right out of the river. Just don't go telling the sheriff. Not my fault if a deer gets in the way of my shot.
With another grunt, the shop owner unlocks a display behind him to take a black box from the shelf, the ammunition inside shifting in a deadly whisper. I linger at the glass case, even though the urge to jump on Eric's back and strangle him with my bare hands breaks over me in waves. Why does a man like that get whatever he wants? get away with whatever he wants. Hurt anyone and anything he wants. I stare down at the knives, and they seem to whisper in their cases, reflecting their possibilities back at me. It doesn't have to be that way. I'm still staring down into the acid-etched patterns on the steel of a hunting blade when I hear the door open and close as Eric leaves. Shuffling footsteps follow and come to a stop at my side.
Stay away from that guy. He's a piece of shit.
The old man says as he unlocks the glass case and passes me the exact knife I'm looking at in the row of blades, as though it's whispered to him as much as it has to me. Kinda got that impression? I take the knife he offers by the handle and turn it over to examine the swirling patterns of the Damascus steel blade. As the shop owner takes out the sheath and runs me through some of the specs, I glance through the front window. Eric is across the street, waving to a group of people our age. He opens the rear door of a black truck and tosses the box of ammunition on the back seat before he walks toward the liquor store. It's perfect, I say, interrupting the old man. I'll take it. The shop owner rings up my order and I slap down enough cash to cover the total. I don't wait for the couple of dollars of change. With my new sheathed blade gripped between my teeth, I hobble my way toward the door at speed. The old man behind the counter must see a lot of oddities in his shop because he merely grunts a goodbye as I limp into the merciless summer sun. I scan the street. There's no one around other than the group Eric just parted with, and they're already a block away, their backs to me. No one even looks my way as I cross the road and throw open the unlocked rear driver's side door of Eric's Dodge Ram 1500 truck. It's a bit of a mess, thank fuck, with a box of tools and some empty soda cans and a grease-stained set of overalls strewn across the seat. It might be a bit gross, but it makes it even less likely that he'll notice me. I shove my crutches in across the footwells, and then I heave myself inside and cover myself with a blanket that smells faintly of mildew and diesel. I clutch my new blade to my chest, and then I wait. It's only a few moments before I hear the tailgate drop and a couple of cases of beer slide onto the bed beneath the tonneau cover. There's some rummaging, and a moment later, the tailgate slams shut. My heart crashes against my bones as heavy boots smack the asphalt. With a grunt, Eric gets into the truck, clicks his seatbelt into place, and a moment later, we're gliding away from the curb to the sound of country music and Eric's off-key whistle. I hear the hiss of a can opening as he cracks a beer, as though that's perfectly normal. Where are we headed? I have no fucking idea, but I'm sure it will be an adventure. That's how I have to think of it. An adventure. Last time I tried to kill a man, it didn't go well because I wasn't prepared. Not that I'm really prepared now, but at least I have more of the element of surprise. And a better weapon, too. Does the thought of those cocktail sticks quivering in Matt Cranwell's eyeball still make me nauseated? Sure, a little. Though right now, it could also be Eric's driving and this mildewy smell from the blanket. But the only way I'm going to get good at this is to practice on a deserving candidate. And it seems like everyone around here knows that Eric fits the bill. Okay, the shop guy is just one person, but he's old and grumpy as fuck, and if he doesn't like Eric, that should count for the opinion of most of the town. So, practice on Eric I shall. I just have to psych myself up. And that's what I do as we head through the town. I imagine how this time it's going to go smoothly. He'll park, I'll spring up, I'll slice his jugular, end scene. Maybe one or two doubts start to creep in, like how I'm going to dispose of the body, for one. I figure most problems can be solved with fire. Getting back to town might be another issue, especially now as we pick up speed and the town roads turn to country highways. But then Eric opens his third beer of the journey and places a call to Naomi to spend the next 10 minutes berating her. And I can hear the broken notes of hopelessness and exhaustion heavy in her voice. I realize the issue of how to get home is a problem I can solve when I'm done, even if it takes all day to hobble my way back into town. Gravel crunches beneath the tires as we take a right turn onto a side road. Then another turn onto an uneven surface, as though the road is rarely used and difficult to traverse. Eric hums along to a song on the radio, seemingly unbothered by the terrain, or his shitty-as-fuck attitude, or anything at all, really. At least until a phone rings. My phone. Van Halen, somebody get me a doctor. I know Fionn's name and face will be lighting up the screen. I scramble to silence the phone, but it slips from my pocket and drops between the rungs of my crutches, hitting the footwell with a damning thump.
What the fuck?
Eric screeches as the vehicle swerves on the uneven road. It's now or never. I toss the blanket aside as I burst from my hiding place, my shining new blade clutched tight in my fist. Ta-da, motherfucker! Push to shove. Rose. Eric screeches an octave higher than I thought possible, his eyes wide as they connect with mine in the rearview mirror. The truck careens off the road and into a field, and before he can figure out what to tackle first, I take my chance. I punch the point of my blade into the side of his neck and push. The sharpened steel slides into his flesh to the sound of his startled, liquid cry, and then I whip it back out in a rush of blood. A garbled, choking cough fills the truck as blood sprays from the wound in pulsing bursts, coating everything. The windows, the seats, the hand he holds to the gaping wound. Me? My stomach heaves, and I puke on the smelly old blanket. Oh, holy shit, that is so fucking gross, I hiss as I shove the blanket aside. Eric is squirming in his seat, but growing weaker with every moment that passes, his gurgling breaths shallow and labored. The truck rolls on through the field, but it's slowing down, bumping along through the prairie grass at a pace that's not much faster than a walk. Eric is still gulping for air as I look through the blood-spattered windshield to get my bearings. In the distance, there are more fields of long grasses, their tips bleached by the summer sun. Just beyond the front bumper is a shallow, washed-out thread of dry sand that must form a little creek in heavy rains. And in between, a steep drop into a river. Fuck. Gotta run, I say, as I sheathe my blade and open the rear driver's side door, tossing one of my crutches into the grass. Eric gurgles, and I struggle to swallow another wave of nausea when our eyes meet in the rearview. His face is smeared with blood, his skin pale. His half-lidded eyes are pleading. Don't look at me like that. You know you're a piece of shit. Eric slumps forward against the steering wheel, and the truck keeps bumbling along. I toss my knife and my other crutch out the door, pocket my now silent phone, and jump out, landing in the grass with an aching thud. I roll over to watch as the truck nears the drop-off, veering into the sandy trail of the dried creek bed. The vehicle slows, and it slows some more. No, 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 get in the river! But the front wheels slide to the side, mere feet from the drop-off. The truck sinks into the sand, and then stops moving forward altogether. The engine still runs, and country music drones from the open door, the man in the driver's seat motionless. Fuck! I grab my knife first, because one can never be too careful, of course, and more important, I just paid a shit ton of money for this thing, and it's already proved itself worth every penny. It takes a minute to figure out the position of the straps, but I manage to harness it against my back. Then I gather my crutches and hobble to the truck to figure out what to do. When I open the door, the scent of hot blood and piss and shit smack me in the face. I undo Eric's seatbelt and shove him toward the center console until his bloodied torso and floppy arms drop toward the passenger seat. I'm not sure I'm cut out for this, I admit, as I haul myself onto the rail and use my crutch to press down on the accelerator. The wheels spin and drop deeper into the sand. I try shifting the truck into reverse, but that doesn't get me anywhere either. My phone rings on my seventh attempt to free the vehicle, when the realization has crept in that I am well and truly fucked. I cut the engine and brace myself in the hope that my gut feeling is right about the good doctor being not so good, even though I have nothing to go on lately that my instincts are in any way reliable. Hi, Dr. Kane. A warm chuckle flows through the line.
You've been living at my house for a week. Fionn is fine.
Right. Fionn.
What's the matter? Is something wrong?
I squint out across the ravine that's just a few short feet away, yet feels unreachable. I'm in a bit of a quandary. I got the jump on a Fleabag townie and it kind of backfired. There's a pause.
You what?
Got the jump on a townie. He was a Fleabag.
What do you mean by got the jump on him?
I cast a frown at the cooling body. Well, here goes. Maybe you should just come and take a look. I could use a hand or two. I'll drop you a pin. It's probably best to keep it to yourself. Fionn takes a sharp breath to ask a question, but I hang up with a cringe and quickly drop him a pin before I pocket my phone. Well, I say, as I pat Eric's lifeless arm, this whole experience could have gone better, probably. But I didn't pass out, so I'll take that as a win. And you brought celebratory beer. Before the nausea creeps in once more, I gather my crutches and slam the door shut before I limp my way to the back of the truck. I pop the tailgate down and grab a can of Coors Light from the cooler. Fionn blows up my phone with calls I don't answer and texts I mostly ignore. There's only one response I can give to his barrage of questions. You'll see what I mean when you get here. 30 minutes later, I spot his truck barreling down the deserted road, a cloud of dust billowing in his wake. He slows when he nears the location of the dropped pin, but it takes him a moment to spot me waving from the bed of the truck, the vehicle clearly not where anyone would expect it to be. Fionn stops and cuts the engine, then marches in my direction, steps that slow and nearly halt as he takes in the state of my clothes. And then he's running straight for me.
Jesus, Rose!
He says, his Irish accent breaking free as panic etches lines in his face.
What happened? Are you hurt?
I'm fine. Though I give him a reassuring smile, it does nothing to untangle the knot of anxiety that twists my guts. Fionn's eyes travel over every inch of me, searching for injuries that he won't find. I had a slight incident.
Slight incident?
He echoes. Though it seems to take a second for the words to click together in his thoughts, his focus still consumed by hunting for the source of the blood.
What do you mean, slight incident?
There was this guy, is all I managed to get out before Fionn's gripped my shoulders, his eyes molten as they pierce right into me.
Some guy did this to you?
No, not exactly. I look away to the tinted rear windows of the truck, but when I turn back, Fionn's still watching me with an intensity that scorches the chambers of my heart. This guy was really a piece of shit. I was in a shop, and he was threatening a woman over the phone, and then he tried to come on to me with some lame-ass line about a fishing hole or some shit. I don't know. I don't know shit about fish.
The point, Rose.
The point is I look to the grass, the sky, the ravine. The truck, though it seems to mock me. I shrug, trying to shrink from the weight of Fionn's gaze that still burns a hole into my face. When I finally meet his eyes once more, I cringe. I started it.
You started it.
Yeah.
Aren't you supposed to say he started it?
Probably. Maybe he did start it with the whole dickhead phone call fish loser thing. So, more accurately, I guess I finished it? Fionn lets go of my arms. He takes a step back and runs a hand through his hair, his expression slack as though the blossoming epiphany has wiped it clean of emotion. He walks to the front of the vehicle and opens the driver's side door, and I hear the sharp intake of breath, the curses on the next exhale. The truck jostles as he steps up on the driver's side and checks for signs of life. I already know there's nothing to find. There's a long, terrifying, heavy silence. A red-tailed hawk cries in the sky above, the only sound on the windswept plains. I try to look as non-threatening as possible as Fionn slowly returns to the tailgate. I hold out a sweaty can of beer as an offering. Would you like one? Fionn stares at the dried blood streaked across my skin, though the condensation has rehydrated some of it. The aluminum is smeared with crimson streaks. He watches as I hastily wipe the can and my palm on my jean shorts and offer it to him again. He won't miss it, I suggest. Might as well.
What the fuck is happening?
He asks. I want to remind him that he's a smart guy, he can probably figure it out. But I chew my lip and just wait for him to voice a few conclusions.
Did you kill him?
Yes, but he's not a good guy.
And you called me to help you to what? Get rid of him?
I shrug. I got a little stuck. And you specifically said, any trouble whatsoever, call me. This is trouble whatsoever.
I didn't mean killing someone and disposing of their body.
I did the killing part. I just need a little help with the disposal. Fionn lets out an exasperated sigh.
Body disposal was not on my list of trouble.
You should have clarified that from the beginning. I push the beer in his direction. Fionn drags his hand down his face and looks toward the sky as though angels might swoop down and save him. But the more I watch him and try to decode the series of cogs and wheels that must be turning in the confines of his skull, the more I realize a critical detail. You're not freaking out. Fionn turns his gaze to me, his eyes narrowing.
I am. On the inside.
Not that much. And you said killing, not murdering.
Same thing.
Not really. He folds his arms across his chest and squares off in front of me.
Explain.
Killing is like, someone is dead because of me, but maybe it's an oops. Fionn snorts.
I highly doubt this is an oops.
But murder is like, I totally meant to do that.
Did you mean to do it?
That's not the point.
It's not?
He asks. I lift a shoulder and Fionn's head tilts.
Then what could possibly be the point if it's not you fucking killed someone?
You said killed, and killed is nicer. I slosh the beer side to side in a last chance gesture, but when he doesn't take it, I stuff it in the front pocket of my plaid shirt. Your loss. Follow me, Doc, I say, positioning my crutches so I can safely hop down from the tailgate. Fionn moves closer as though he can't stop the urge to offer his help, but he does stop himself in the end. He halts just shy of taking my arm and then stands back to watch as I swing my way to the driver's door. When I pull it open, he's still standing where I left him. I'm not going to hurt you. I just want to show you something. Fionn looks toward his vehicle, parked on the dirt road. I'm sure the pull is strong to get away from here, to go back to life the way it was before I appeared like some kind of fever dream. Part of him probably wants to crawl back into the shadows and imagine this is all just a strange nightmare that might cling to his consciousness for a few days before it fades from memory. I know what it's like to hide, and I know what it's like to be found. It can be exhilarating to be seen, and it can be terrifying to be exposed. I guarantee I don't enjoy this as much as you'd think, I say, pulling the beer from my pocket and cracking it open. I take a long swig in an effort to swallow the churning unease that creeps up my throat. With a deep sigh, Fionn turns toward me and stops at my side.
That's reassuring.
I give him a tentative smile that isn't returned, and then take a deep breath and hold it, setting my beer down on the dash. I turn toward Eric's body to start patting him down for his phone. When I tug his torso into place to sit upright on the driver's seat, I find it in his front pocket. As with pretty much everything in the truck, it's covered with blood, so I wipe it off on my shorts.
That's good. Make sure you get the evidence really embedded in the fibers,
Fionn says. In for a penny, in for a pound. I turn back to the corpse and hover the screen in front of his face, but it doesn't unlock. When I use the edge of his shirt to wipe the blood from his skin, that doesn't work either.
His eyes need to be open for the face ID to work,
Fionn says flatly. How about now? I pull his eyelids open and try again, but still nothing. Bear with me a minute, Doc. Leaving my crutches to rest against the open door, I hop off the rail and over to the rear of the cab, climbing onto the back seat to rummage through the box of tools. With a squeak of triumph, I find the perfect tool to help.
Sweet Jesus, Rose.
Call it circus ingenuity, I say, as I hop back to the front of the vehicle with my prize in my hand. I climb onto the rail and hold open one of Eric's eyelids with one hand, lining up the staple gun with his lash line. Last time I used one of these, I stapled a curtain to my hand, so let's hope for the best. Fionn's whispered curses fall into the backdrop as I press the handle down, pop a staple into his eyelid to attach it to the flesh below his brow, and then turn to Wretch.
You might want to find another hobby,
he offers. I cough. Wretch again. Take a few deep breaths and a swig of the beer sitting on the dash. I'm good.
Have you had this reaction to blood and gore before?
Not really. Though, maybe, now that you mention it, I did pass out during the curtain incident. Woke up to Jim flapping my arm around like a wing.
What about when I found you passed out on the floor in my exam room?
Well, I thought that one didn't count, all things considered.
I think it still counts.
With a fleeting smile and shrug, I turn back to my task and repeat the process with Eric's other eyelid. Pop, staple, Wretch. Blood seeps over the surface of his eyes, so when I've managed to subdue the urge to vomit, I take my can of beer from the dash and pour a line of liquid across his brow to wash it away.
Dear God,
Fionn says, and it comes out more like a resigned groan than any true shock.
This is a fucking travesty.
I know, right? What a waste of good beer on this asshole.
That's not exactly what I meant.
Though I toss him a grin as I dab Eric's eyeballs and face dry, Fionn only frowns, a deep sigh lifting his chest and his muscled shoulders. Okay, I say. Then prod one side of Eric's lips to make a lopsided smile that falls as soon as I let go. I hold the device up to his face, and this time, it finally unlocks the home screen. Success! I slide off the rail and open his text messages. Half the snippets displayed only confirm what I already know, that he was cheating on Naomi with multiple women. Hey, baby, what are you doing tonight? Wanna come over? I miss you. And then I open his text exchange with Naomi. The rage I feel as I skim the conversation has me wishing I could do it all over again. Make him suffer. Bleed longer. Staple his eyes open and let him fall over that cliff while he was still alive so he could feel concentrated fear distilled to its purest form. Naomi must have lived in fear every day. Fear of being with him. Of being without him. Fear of leaving only to face his retribution. Any doubts I might have had about what I've done are erased when I read his threats and insults, his backhanded, controlling compliments, and his unhinged, narcissistic outbursts. My nose stings when I think of the suffering Naomi must have endured daily when she woke to this reality, her chest tightening as consciousness took hold, her stomach hollow. I remember that feeling. How worry and hopelessness can carve out your center, leaving you scraped clean. How every waking moment becomes corrupted by the kind of dread that pulses just beneath your skin, a second heartbeat humming in the dark. I clear my throat, but it does nothing to dislodge the knot that pulls tighter around my every breath. He's been abusing Naomi Whitaker, the nurse at the hospital, I whisper, offering the phone to Fionn. Threats. Intimidation. He struck her recently, she told me while I was there. The shock in Fionn's face is replaced with the slow dawn of epiphany.
You mean, just like Matthew Cranwell has been abusing Lucy?
He says, and it's not a question, but a carefully delivered statement of fact. something like that.
Did you start that fight too?
I shrug. I guess it depends on how you look at it, Doc. He watches me for a moment, a crease between his brows. With a tentative hand, he takes the mobile, but he seems reluctant to remove his gaze from mine. Maybe it's the glassy sheen he sees in my eyes, the way tears gather on my lash line. I nod to the phone and force a smile. Go ahead, before it locks and I have to rinse his eyeballs with beer again. Fionn's brows pull tighter, and then he looks down at the phone. I see every minute change. The flush of crimson that dusts his cheeks, the way his pulse quickens on the side of his neck, the parting of his lips, the subtle shake of his head. He scrolls through the messages, once, twice, three times, and he's probably read more now than I have. He sees something that makes his fingers tense around the phone before he locks it and slides it into his pocket, as though he can't stand to look at it another moment longer. He unbuttons the cuff of one of his sleeves, rolling the pressed gray fabric up his forearm, his muscles tense.
Keep watch on the road,
he says as he repeats the motion with his other sleeve, his voice gruff, his eyes never straying from mine.
If you see a cloud of dust in either direction, tell me.
I nod once and he takes a step closer, our connection unbroken as he reaches for the half-full can of beer to take a long sip. And then he turns and stalks away. He pulls a small knife from his pocket, unfolding it as he bends to unscrew the cap on the tire valve. He presses the tip of the blade to the core and air hisses from the tire. When Fionn is finished airing down each one, he returns to my side, repocketing the blade.
Start it up, wheels to the left, put it in four-wheel drive. When I tell you, give it just a little gas.
Okay. He heads to the back of the truck and prepares to push as I press the brake with my crutch. I start the engine, shifting it into drive. When he's ready, he gives me the signal, and with the slow, steady crawl of the deflated tires and his rhythmic pushing, the truck finally glides free of the sand. I stay on the rail until we near the edge, and then I take my crutch off the accelerator and let it crawl forward. Eyes on the prize, dickhead, I say, and with a final salute to Eric's dead body, I hop down from the vehicle, taking Fionn's waiting hand as he slams the door shut with the other. The truck rolls to the cliff edge, and we follow to watch it tumble down the steep embankment, gathering momentum. It hits a boulder and flips, then cartwheels end over end until it smacks the surface of the slow gray current to sink into the silty gloom.
Investigators are really going to have questions if the body turns up with his eyes stapled open,
Fionn says as the last tire disappears from view. Bubbles pop in the swirling eddies and we watch in silence until the last one dies and the water resumes its slow procession. He turns to face me then, and I'm not sure how to read the mask that watches me back. There are hardly any clues to what he must be thinking, just a feathering of the muscle along his jaw, a haunted spark in his eyes, like a candle nearly burned to the end of its wick, fighting to hold off the dark. He must realize I'm trying to read him, because he breaks our connection and bends to retrieve the crutch I dropped when I took his offered hand.
Let's hope he never turns up,
he finally says. We don't talk. Not as he helps me into his car, even though he doesn't need to. Not when he turns the truck around to head back to the main road. Neither one of us remarks on the thunderstorm that looms in the distance, or how its black heart bursts with bright streaks of light in the palest shade of pink. It's beautiful, and I want to say it out loud, but I don't. It isn't until we're on the other side of Weyburn and well past the town limits that Fionn pulls Eric's phone from his pocket. He wipes it clean, and then he veers to the center of the empty highway and tosses it out the window into the ditch on the opposite side of the road. And he doesn't look back.
Sutures. Fionn. I never thought I'd find crocheting meditative and soothing, but here we are. I'm sure my brothers would have a field day if they knew that I was holed up in my room like a hermit, spending my Saturday night crocheting a fucking blanket. But I guess they equally take the piss out of me for my gym obsession. Or as Lachlan likes to call it, my Dr. Bellend gym bro phase. and Rowan would be chiming in with some unhelpful suggestions, or even worse, he'd take up crocheting just long enough to make me a mankini for my birthday. While Lachlan is a broody asshat, Rowan is fucking nuts and will go to literally any lengths to make a point or get what he wants, no matter how reckless or ridiculous or absurd. The two of them together are the worst, and the torment would be never ending if they found out all the details of my life at present. Especially seeing as how the most beautiful but admittedly also terrifying woman I've ever met is sleeping in the room across from mine, and I've done nothing but try to force myself to avoid her as much as possible. I haven't been doing a great job of it either. Even when I'm at work or running through town or at the gym, Rose will suddenly appear in my thoughts. I'll hear her voice, that desperate whispered help, still a barb in my mind. Or I'll see her face, like her startled expression when I pulled the door of her motorhome open for her, the way her eyes glimmered in the summer sun when she realized it was me. I came here to Hartford in the hope that I would isolate myself from the things that made me weak, that made me want to poke and prod the hidden dark corners of my mind. But from the moment Rose showed up, she's invaded my thoughts as though she's stripping my immunity cell by cell. But it's not me I'm worried about. It's her. I lower the blanket I'm working on and pan my gaze across the room. Simple furniture. Nondescript paintings. Impersonal details on display, all of it dull and unoriginal. Nothing that would provoke any emotion or raise any concern. Nothing you'd look at and think, this belongs to a man who covered up a murder yesterday. Or, this belongs to a man who nearly bludgeoned a farmer to death with a wrench. And certainly not, this belongs to a man who killed his own father and nobody knows it was him. I set the blanket aside and brace my elbows on my knees, pressing my palms to my eyes as though it will push those thoughts back where they belong. But they never truly fade away. I still see my father in his drunken and drug-induced rage, still remember with vivid clarity the disappointment I felt when he returned after a week of being missing, those glorious few days when I'd started to believe he'd finally been killed as the ultimate consequence of his shitty life choices. After all, I was the one who discovered who he owed, who he stole from. It was me who thought if I let the Mays family know that he'd taken money from them, they would get rid of my father for good. With every day that had passed that week, I realized I didn't feel the way any decent person would for selling out their own father. Me? I felt relief. Even pride. I felt fucking invincible. But I was just a kid. I underestimated my father's ability to get himself out of trouble. All that growing hope and serenity I felt was suddenly washed away when he reappeared on Saturday afternoon, slurring and cursing as he shoved my brother Rowan into the kitchen of our childhood home in Sligo, demanding a meal. He smacked Rowan across the face when my brother protested. When I tried to intervene, he shoved me against the counter and knocked my head against the cupboard hard enough that I saw stars. But through the flashing light, I still caught the way my brother's eyes turned black with rage. How he looked to Lachlan where he stood in the living room, his fists curled at his sides. It was as though there was a secret switch that had been flipped between them with that fleeting look. When the last conflict with my father erupted, I slipped a knife into my hand when no one was looking. And I remember how a single word stood out like a beacon as my brothers kicked off the brawl that would end Callum Kane's miserable life. Finally, I thought. Finally. Even now, I still feel the rush of adrenaline, hoping that it would be the end. Knowing it, as though it were part of my blood and bone, my DNA. I've spent every day since trying to prove those instincts wrong. I've tried to be worthy of my brother's devotion, to be worthy of their sacrifices. I've wanted to make up for my role in his death that day. One my brothers didn't even realize I played. And yesterday, it was like I simply succumbed. With a deep sigh, I check my watch. 11:30. Eric Donovan has been dead for over 24 hours. If he hasn't been reported missing already, it's not going to take much longer. The tracks of our vehicles would have been washed away by last night's downpour, if anyone even bothers to look on that deserted patch of land. His vehicle is submerged beneath murky grey water. Maybe, if we're lucky, he'll never be found. Wouldn't a normal person feel remorse? I don't. That's the real reason I'm avoiding the woman across the hall. Because despite what she's done, I'm not afraid of her. I'm afraid for her. And I think about that as I set my crochet project in my bag and slide into bed, chasing sleep. I don't feel remorse. My last conscious thoughts are questions that have no answers. What if I've spent all these years trying to cultivate something within me that just doesn't exist? What if I'm just as much of a monster as the man who made me? When I wake the next morning after a night of restless dreams, Rose is either asleep or out. Both of these options are strange. She's usually up by 6, always before me unless I've taken on an early shift at the hospital. I've gotten used to the smell of waffles and maple syrup and bacon in the morning, and though she makes enough for both of us every time, I always opt for a probiotic shake. But the scent has become welcoming. It feels like home. And Rose seems to enjoy spending the mornings in, making conversation that I tried to keep to a minimum, or laying out the cards of her tarot deck to stare down at them with a crease between her brows. She plays with her wavy fringe when she has trouble interpreting their meaning. Sometimes she whispers, "Ta-da," and twinkles her fingers when she figures it out. Or she hums off-key. Or talks to the deck. Or catches my eye and grins at me as though she knew all along that I was watching like the fucking blue-balled hermit I am. I try to stay professional. Detached. But I feel like I'm caught in her orbit, sucked in by her gravitational pull. And now I'm trying to sense that gravitational pull from outside her door, like some kind of fucking weirdo stalker. I hear nothing. I rap the door with my knuckles, softly at first. When no sound comes from the other side, I knock again, a little louder this time. Rose? Against my better judgment, I open her door. And it's like I've stepped into a room that belongs to someone else's house. The bedspread I bought for her is perfectly smoothed across the mattress. The yellow pillows are propped against the headboard. But there are extra pillows too, not just a few, but maybe a half a dozen of them. In floral patterns and stripes and polka dots that are all mismatched yet somehow work together perfectly. There are framed photos and knickknacks on the nightstand. There's a painting I don't recognize that's propped up on the dresser. And plants. Plants everywhere. A monstera near the bed. Ivy on the shelf. Orchids on the windowsill. 3 spider plants hang suspended from the curtain rod. In a matter of a few days, and entirely without my realizing it, Rose has transformed a once bland and lifeless room into something that feels like a home. It leaves me with many, many questions. Such as, where the fuck did she get all these plants? And when? How? She couldn't have done it by herself. So who helped her? And where the fuck is she? And why does it worry me so goddamn much that she's not here? I stop in front of one of the plants lined up on the dresser next to a mortar and pestle, the inner surface of the bowl stained with purple streaks. The first plant I don't recognize. It has small indigo flowers and glossy dark berries. Beside it, there's a small shrub with blossoms that look like pale pink stars. The third plant in the row has hood-shaped purple flowers clustered around a vertical stem. This one I know. It's monk's hood, also known as wolfsbane, a highly poisonous plant. I take a few more steps into the room and lean in to look at the photos on the nightstand. Teenage Rose in her motorcycle gear, flanked by twin boys. Rose, a few years older, her arm around a woman in an elaborate costume. One of Jose Silveria, standing proud beneath a curved sign of lights. "Silveria Circus," it says. His voice surfaces from a few weeks ago, when he wrapped me in an unexpected embrace in Rose's hospital room. "Take good care of our Rose. She needs this. She just doesn't know it yet." I don't know if anyone needs a broken leg or a hospital stay or to be left behind in an unfamiliar town, but I nodded anyway. I'm about to leave when I notice a postcard from Colorado Springs leaning against one of the frames. I turn it over.
Dear Sparrow, I wanted to thank you. I was afraid, but I was more afraid of what would happen if I never took flight. Thank you for giving me my wings back. Sincerely, M.
I can't know for sure what the note means, but I think after the last few days, and given the row of plants on her dresser, I might have a clue. I take one last look around the hidden garden of my guest room and leave, stalking out of the house with my bag of yarn and my half-finished blanket and my crochet hook slung over my shoulder. When I make it to Sandra's house 4 blocks away, I don't know if I'd rather turn around and go home to stew in my morose confusion, or immerse myself in the Suture sisters' gossip, in the fragile hope of taking my mind off Rose. And that hope is immediately shattered when I enter Sandra's home.
Hey, Doc, how's it hanging?
I come to a dead stop in Sandra's foyer, my jaw slack, my expression dumbfounded. Rose is surrounded by the Suture sisters' crochet group, her leg propped up on an ottoman and a backpack resting next to her on the floor. A sly grin spreads across Rose's face as she watches me standing motionless like a malfunctioning robot, my brain seemingly detached from my body.
Dr. Kane,
Sandra says, and I finally break my gaze away from Rose when the host of our club swans into view. Her petite hand wraps around my wrist and she tows me into the living room.
Your friend Rose has come to join us today. Turns out she's an avid crocheter. Did you know that?
No, I reply as she leads me to the chair across from Rose and passes me a glass of lemonade. I did not know that.
I wouldn't say avid, necessarily.
Rose's eyes don't leave mine as she leans forward to grab her bag from the floor and opens it, withdrawing a ball of black yarn and a set of crochet hooks.
My gran taught me growing up, and I like to dabble from time to time. But I might be a little out of practice. I'm probably not as good as Doc.
The other Suture sisters eat that shit up. Maud and Tina let out synchronized awes from where they sit on a velvet love seat, as Liza, the group's most voracious gossip, snorts a laugh, reaching over to pat Rose's arms with her liver-spotted hand.
You're far too kind, Rosie dear.
Rose doesn't correct her on the mispronunciation of her name. Quite the opposite, in fact. With the way she beams a devious little smirk at me, I'm pretty sure she's already earned Rosie as a nickname, despite the fact she's been here all of 2 seconds and doesn't know these women. How the fuck did she get here, and why the hell is this simultaneously grinding my gears, and adorable, and hot as fuck? It's like she set off a bomb in my thoughts, and now they're scattered everywhere, a mess I can't hope to make sense of. And she's loving every second of it.
I've seen your doilies,
Rose whispers, her eyes still latched to mine, innocent and wide, though the gleam in them is pure mischief.
I thought the one in the living room was really good. Bless your heart,
Sandra says as she tops up Rose's lemonade. Then she sits down next to Maud, who's the quietest of the bunch, her focus captured by the work of her hands.
Dr. Kane.
Fionn, please.
Fionn, you didn't tell us you had such a delightful young lady staying at your home.
Maud and Tina share a weighted glance. Liza grins down into her yarn.
Yes, well...
I clear my throat, trying to avoid the burn of Rose's gaze on my face. I pull my yarn and hooks from my bag, laying them out on my lap before I start my first stitch. Rose had an accident and needed a place to recover, so here we are.
She told us. A motorcycle accident. Such a shame, but you can stay as long as you like.
I'll have to get back to the circus as soon as I'm healed.
Rose interjects as though she's saving me from an explanation I'm ill-prepared to give. To be honest, I've felt ill-prepared for all the moments that have passed since I walked through Sandra's door this morning. But I feel even more blindsided by the wave of disappointment at the prospect of her departure.
I'm sure Fionn will grow tired of my antics soon enough, anyway.
I snort.
Nonsense, dear. I'm pretty sure our good doctor has had more excitement in the last few days than he has in the last few years. Isn't that right, dear?
Sandra says, her grey eyebrows hiked halfway up her forehead as she pins her gaze on me. Before I can answer, Liza leans forward in her chair, her eyes darting from one person to the next.
Speaking of excitement, have you heard about that Donovan boy?
My heart stops beating and drops through my guts. When I look at Rose, the colour has drained from her face, but she does an admirable job of staying composed as the suture sisters speak over one another with questions that Liza can't keep up with to answer.
Christina Donovan's boy? The one in Weyburn? I thought she had two boys. Which one is it? Did someone finally throw them in jail? Eric, the younger one. He's missing.
Liza finally gets out, and the other women gasp and tisk.
Last anyone saw him, he was buying some beer. Told some friends he was going fishing, but didn't say where. He never showed up for work, and he's not answering his phone. Just disappeared.
Panic still crawls through my veins, but at least my heart restarts when it settles in that he hasn't been found. I make some agreeable noises when they say how sad it is for Christina, or that he probably just went on a bender and will turn up in a day or two. But I don't miss Maud's muttered words beneath the fray.
Let's hope he doesn't come back.
I'm so focused on catching every shred of the rapid-fire chatter that it takes me a moment to feel the weight of Rose's attention on my face. When I meet her gaze, I see worry in her eyes, and then determination. And frankly, it's the latter that truly scares me. The conversation is still churning when Rose taps Sandra on the arm and pushes her crochet work toward her for inspection.
Do you think this yarn will be strong enough?
I take a sip of my lemonade, trying to swallow the dread that's crept up my throat as Sandra scrutinizes Rose's pattern with a furrowed brow.
That depends. What are you making, dear?
A sex swing?
Lemonade shoots up my nose and burns. I cough and sputter my way through what would otherwise be a moment of suspended silence. But that only lasts for a blessed few seconds before I'm surrounded by a flurry of voices that tosses me into an alternate reality.
You'll need a softer heft for that. Maybe try the Mille Mia Merino. You might want to consider a tighter crochet stitch.
Is it for you?
Maud asks without looking up.
Or does it need to take the weight of an adult man? Like, say, maybe the doctor's size?
I drag a hand down my face as though it will scrape away my blush. Jesus, Maud.
I don't know.
Rose says as she looks toward the ceiling, tapping her lip with the end of her crochet hook.
Maybe. I'm not sure.
What about tensile bamboo yarn, soft and strong?
Did you find a pattern?
Rose shrugs. I die a little.
I was just going to wing it. I have a pattern for a pot hanger.
Liza chimes in, pulling her bag onto her lap so she can rummage through the contents. She finds a magazine and flips it open, pointing to a photo of a crocheted hanging planter.
You could use this. Maybe make leg holes right here. Ooh, what about...